Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. And this is a podcast really centered around one singular proposition, that the Russian Orthodox faith in all of its guises, political, economic, monastic, is the very core, the essence of the fight against the New World Order. The New World Order is defined as, in simple economic terms, the desire of an oligarchy, a handful of multinational corporations, to destroy all borders amongst peoples, legal barriers, things like currency and regulation, in order to create a huge global market where workers would receive pennies, capital would be very mobile, and they would be in charge of the laws and rules governing this dystopia. Now, the New World Order, globalization, these absolutely, it affects, there is no aspect of life that it's not affected by. It affects religion, it affects the way we think, it affects our language, it affects politics and economics, it affects academia, it affects our education. There is nothing that is not affected by it. It is absolutely totalitarian in that respect. And that Russia, as I began saying in the mid-90s, I was saying it relative to General Alexander Lebed at the time, Putin starting in 1999 or so, Russia will be the core of it. She's the core of it because it was the Third Rome up until 1918. It was, you know, and as such, it was this restrainer of Antichrist. But in more mundane terms, it had the size and the population, a very anti-Western population. Anti-Western meaning anti-capitalist, anti-liberal. And it had the resources and the military and the background to be the essence of this fight. A small nation couldn't do it. A country like Serbia, although extremely valuable in this fight, is too tiny and doesn't have the resources to be the center of things. And the engine here has been the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, which is both an economic and a military alliance between China and Russia, but includes countries such as all of the Central Asia and Iran, as well as, believe it or not, Turkey as an observer, and of course the BRICS organization in economic terms. What's driving this ultimately is pure profit. If there is one single labor market, that means any worker is going to be receiving almost nothing. The creation of one language, one currency, one state globally would reduce transaction costs to an absolute minimum. And everything would be defined in monetary terms. The first time this was attempted, of course, is the Tower of Babel that God destroyed. And the secret societies, you know, the Freemasonry, the OTO, etc., they keep making reference to the antediluvian wisdom, the wisdom of Atlantis, or whatever name is attached to it. This is a society that was destroyed by God, saving only a small remnant in the ark. It was a very literate society. It was highly technical. It was very advanced in a scientific sense. But no question in my mind that it was absolutely oligarchic and demonic, in that all passions have been loosened. Sodom and Gomorrah may have actually been, in some odd way, surviving remnants of that society. All secret societies, no matter where that you go, make reference to this antediluvian wisdom, anti meaning before or previous to. So that's the nature of this show. That's the nature of my life. That's the nature of my career. That's why I'm here. That's my mission in the world, And actually, it's quite a gift to know what my purpose is, or what anyone's purpose is, what my vocation is. I appeal to, again to my listeners for financial assistance. A few of you have responded, and to those of you who I haven't gotten to yet, I thank you profusely. Not even for the financial assistance is good enough, but the fact that there are some of you out there willing to give like that to me blows my mind entirely. For those of you who don't know, over the last 3 years, I've been put through the ringer in the family court system with a divorce that I didn't want, and child custody issues that keep dragging on. I lost my job at Penn State because of this. Someone made a phone call, and I was only teaching a few classes there, but I was slated to teach many, many more because they liked me. I have no idea what was said to them. There's been no other legal issues involved in this, so I don't know what was said. But all of a sudden, with some of the best student evaluations in at the time, they're not interested in renewing my contract. So there's no question something happened. And this has just been a nightmare. It's not like I'm spending all this money and have all this debt from that, from buying shoes. This is I've seen the system up close and personal. I knew it was bad. I didn't know it was this bad. And this is why the Orthodox Nationalists went silent for a while. Starting roughly, I believe, the last episode was in 2012. I began, this is the 30th show since I have revived the program. But that's really the reason. I was still writing and working, but to be honest, I simply didn't have the energy or the desire or the motivation to continue with anything extra like this. Given all that was happening. And I'll never be the same again. I'll never get over it. I might feel better about it, but I'll never get over it. As I was in the middle of this, I said I'd rather have cancer. And I know people with cancer. I've been there. I know many people with cancer, actually. I'd rather have cancer than to go through what I've been put through. My record is 4 days without sleep, on sleep medication. That's how bad it got. That was at the very beginning, and costs and things like moving and lawyers, and the constant travel to different. It's why I moved to Johnstown. Johnstown, as some of you know, is the most Slavic city in America, the most Orthodox city in America per capita. That was the case in far greater terms years and years ago. Most of you know that Johnstown was a major industrial center. In this country, was feeding Pittsburgh its coal, but also has its own industry in its own right. And in my house, I'm on top of a mountain, and I could actually see the dead factories way below underneath me, which is it's a beautiful view actually in general, but those are a constant reminder of what happens, what the New World Order really is. I have a podcast on the matriarchy that we live in. Every once in a while I do some work for the county bar associations, just some research work. I do a lot of legal research, and they asked me to deal with some of the family court issues, stuff that I hadn't been through personally, but I knew was pretty bad, and it was so awful. The cases that I was reading and the laws that I had unearthed, the regulations that I'd seen, that I had to actually call three trial lawyers, one of whom is female, and asked if I'm not going crazy. Is this really the case? It's so bad. I had no idea. What I've been through is peanuts compared to guys who have a restraining order put on them or who have been accused of domestic violence, these kind of things. It's peanuts compared to that. And I don't know how anyone could survive this, where your life can be destroyed, your reputation destroyed without any proof or evidence whatsoever, and that's written into the law itself. And I would be most happy to send you a list of the court decisions in the state of Pennsylvania that show that no evidence is required. This is why you have a high suicide rate for men going through this. Thank God that's one thing I never had. I never wanted to kill myself. I thank God for that. Many, many men do for whatever reason. Suicide was always very bizarre to me. How would somebody who believes that they're a loser, who can get nothing right, suddenly believe that they'll be perfect in that just that act. Everything else they botch except killing themselves. Because often if they botch it, they'll end up in a vegetable. But just that one thing, that they'll get right. And then the other question is, where do they think they're going? I mean, even if they just don't know, they have no evidence at all that where they're going to go is going to be any better than what they have. It seems to be a very strange thing. I've always thought of it as just they're screaming to the world that this is how miserable I am. I'm this bad off. I've been treated this badly that the only thing that I can do is this expression of my loathing in suicide. Thank God I've never had that. But there are many, many men who have been in my position and worse that have contemplated it. And men in the middle of divorce, that first 2 years or so, contemplate suicide and they kill themselves in large numbers. Women initiate about 70% of the divorces in America because they profit so handsomely from it. Whether it be in the domestic court, whether it be in terms of crimes, misdemeanors, whether it be different kinds of support, spousal or child, women make out like bandits. I work with the homeless. I've been working with the homeless most of my adult life. I would say that a solid quarter of them are there because of this, that their spousal support and child support and the other legal fees are so high that they simply couldn't afford to live. I had many conversations with men in this position. And many of them, I remember one very distinctly. He looked just like Mario from the video game back when I was in Lincoln, Nebraska. And he said to me, he said, it's just not worth it. I'd rather be here than to just, I simply couldn't do it anymore. It was a financial burden that he couldn't handle, but also was a personal one. That the depression gets so bad, you just stop. You just stop. So I ask again for support. I don't like doing this. I'm ashamed, but it's something that I have to do. So I continue to ask your assistance. I also, many of you know that I was the editor of the Barnes Review for quite some time. I was hired right out of grad school by Willis Cardo, a man who I truly love and respect, very much as a father figure. He never had kids of his own, and he treated many of us like that. He was harsh and difficult in many ways, but there's a side to him that many people don't know. He took a chance on me and hired me in November of 1999, and the place was always struggling. There was a time he had 500,000 subscribers in the 1980s, late 70s, I should say. Because of the nature of the regime, IRS attacks from the Clinton administration years ago, we're struggling. I've always been associated with it. I was the editor for a few years. They went bankrupt, so I had to leave. I was a professor at Mount St. Mary's in Maryland. And then at the death of Willis Cardo, a group of us got back together, hopefully to resuscitate both the Barnes Review and the American Free Press. And I want to ask you to subscribe. The overwhelming majority of what's its pages are nowhere to be found on the web. And it's extremely original. Stuff that you will never see anywhere else. There's no parallel to it elsewhere. I've never asked this before, but the Barnes Review is worth every penny. We really focus not just on pro-Russian, pro-German kind of revisionism, nationalist history, but also really, another way to put it would be we really love to publish historical theses that have no mainstream acceptance and yet are probably true. Academic journals are highly censored. I am one of the peer reviewers, so it is a peer-reviewed journal, at least over the last few years, and that was at my insistence. And it's single blind, not double blind. I know who you are, but you don't know who's actually doing the reviewing. And it's very original. I don't know what else to say. It's very original, and it's changed my life. It was a second education for me being there. So that being said, and it's difficult for me to ask like this. I know I have a lot of listeners and a lot of friends. And so in both of those areas, both of those arenas, I ask your assistance. The topic for today, though, is quite different. It's at the very core of what this web journal is about, what this podcast is about, what my life is about. It's on the life and struggles of the abbot of the Butyrinsky Monastery in Ukraine, Melchizedek Dvorsky, who died in 1809. One of the reasons I'm doing this is that I believe that Abbot Melchizedek should be canonized. I have some theories as to why he hasn't been, but even in Orthodox traditionalist circles, he's almost completely unknown. I've said many times on this show, and I will always say, that Russian nationalists have one kind of weird short circuit in their thinking, and I choose my words carefully here, and that is the 18th century. The canonical foundation of the Russian Orthodox Church was shaken, and the line of monarchs was decisively broken because of Peter I. Now, in God's mercy, you know, he's not going to condemn the common people for that. You know, that has to be, you know, taken care of. I mean, you know, a bishop becomes a heretic, the priests have what the Roman Catholics call supply jurisdiction. He's not going to condemn millions of people because a handful of bishops are corrupt. That's laughable. God can never be associated with injustice, and that would be injustice. Regardless, the 18th century was a time where the common population pulled away from the monarchy, where the monarchy quite rightly lost a huge amount of its legitimacy. And the 18th century is also the time where the old believers took over the Russian peasantry. By 1800, the majority, if not the overwhelming majority, of the Russian peasants were old believers to one extent or another. And you could be an old believer and still be a member of the official church. Their thought process and their mentality was still in the old believer mind. My book on the Old Believers is available, and it's some of my own work as well as translations of others. The rebellions against the Pugachev Rebellion under Catherine II was an Old Believer revolt. The Old Believers have a political agenda, an economic agenda, because everything is connected. They are very much like the prophets of the Old Testament. Now, there's a reason for the Pugachev revolt. And this decisive break of the Romanov line and the illegitimacy of the people who were filling that seat was made very clear. You can't be a monarch of Russia without being Orthodox. And only a handful of monarchs of the 18th century were actually Orthodox. Catherine II was not. I mean, she had been baptized, that's not what I mean, but she believed in nothing. Peter I didn't believe in it at all and was a Freemason. Even his secular biographers admit that. He loathed the church, he hated it, and throughout his reign, he tortured to death the bishop of every major see in the empire. He usually broke them on the wheel. He was absolutely no different than the Bolsheviks, except that he didn't have the technology to be as awful as they were. He was a Satanist, and we know this because his unholy drunken synod, he actually wrote hymns for this, to Bacchus and other pagan demons. And he would parade himself through the streets, exposing himself and things like this. He putting Catherine, the so-called, in quotes, Catherine I, who was a whore, a professional that he had captured on campaign in Germany and had passed around through most of the high command of the army, was illiterate, an alcoholic, who didn't know where she was half the time. This was his successor. It was his way to spit it at the Russian monarchy. If you recall, the French revolutionaries placed a whore on the throne of the martyred Bishop of Paris, the Archbishop of Paris's throne. This is identical. He put a whore on the throne of the Russian state, on the throne. And of course, Byron and his inner circle were all high-level Masons as well. The only break that Russia got was Elizabeth, who was a very, very, very good woman. And I should deal with her. I will have a special podcast just for her because she kind of sticks out like a sore thumb. There is an army of new martyrs. And because of all this, there was a huge amount of Orthodox refugees to Mount Athos and to the Balkans. The Manyava monastery in far western Ukraine is one of these refugee centers. Well, that's quite relevant to the situation we're dealing with here. Abbot Melchizedek was the abbot of this monastery and actually had the position of almost an abbatial dean. He was the abbot of all monasteries on right bank Ukraine, that is to say western Ukraine. Now, 18th century western Ukraine, the very few places in history where it would have been less pleasant to live. This was a Polish possession. And if you know anything about the Polish Empire, you need to realize that it was an oligarchy in the most extreme sense. It was ruled by what's called confederations. This is when an oligarchical family would join with others in the same area to pursue a specific goal. The crown had very little power. The crown, oddly enough, had a tendency to be very sympathetic to the Orthodox cause. But the crown in the 14th century had brought Jews in to the cities as a challenge to the nobility. Unfortunately, what that ended up doing, this happened in Kiev as well, what that did was create an alliance between the nobility and the Jews to shut out the monarchy. And the result is that the nobles never really became business-oriented. And the Jewish oligarchy in the Polish Empire was the worst in history, other than, of course, Khazaria itself, or the U.S. today. They controlled most of the property in the Polish Empire, either directly or indirectly. In western Ukraine, we're talking about something called the Haidamak Revolt of 1768. It was an answer to the Confederation of Bar, B-A-R, which was a very feudal in the economic sense, oriented confederation of a handful of noble families in western Ukraine to completely wipe out Orthodoxy and impose either the Uniates or the Latins. They would prefer the Latins. The Uniates was a compromise between the papacy and the Polish state. The Polish state just wanted them to all be Latins. So the Uniate was kind of a strange. I was a Uniate for a long time. I know their mentality. And I can tell you one thing, and that there is no such thing as Uniate theology. I've searched high and low for a Uniate catechism, and it doesn't exist. Because it isn't really anything. You go to different Uniate churches, then or now, and you don't know what you're going to get. Some are very Orthodox-oriented. Some are very Latin-oriented. Some are very Roman Catholic. Some hardly even know that they're members of the Papal Church. In fact, it's extremely common to hear stories from 1595, when this was imposed in Poland, to this very day of people not realizing that they're members of the Roman Church and being part of the Union. I've been to Uniate churches, and whether they be from Antioch or Ukraine, that are extremely Orthodox. They have icons of John of Kronstadt and Mark of Ephesus on the walls. They won't say the Filioque. There's no mention of purgatory ever. And yet they're members of the Roman Church. This goes far in explaining a fact that I've tried to impress on Catholics for a long time, that the only thing that matters is papal control. It's absurd to think that the papacy was ignorant of this fact. I have never met a Uniate, and I'm sure they exist, but I've never met a Uniate who accepts the Council of Trent. There's no mention of purgatory in anything they ever say or do, because I don't think they believe it. And many other people, they're simple people, even to this day, are not really sure if that they're members of the Catholic Church, or that in their mind, Catholic really just means Orthodox. In some places, there is no difference, not in terms of the liturgy, not in terms of the iconography, not in terms of the theology. The books that they sell, you really can't tell the difference. But the Uniates, for me, were my gateway to Orthodoxy. And one of the reasons, actually the most important reason, I'm pursuing this line of research in my life. He was under the Bishop of Pereslavl, on the other side of the Dnieper, which made communication very difficult between Melchizedek or any of the monasteries there and the where the sea was. The Confederation of Bar engaged in a process of mass forcible conversion. And to them, it wasn't particularly of interest whether or not they became Latins or just the Uniates. They just needed to add the filioque to the creed. And soldiers were stationed in many churches, even country churches, to make sure this was done. And they would leave the minute they heard it. Nothing else was required. And that would be your signal that that they're Catholics. Over time, the theory was, they would become so Latinized that it wouldn't matter anyway. And this is kind of the mentality of the Bar Confederation. The Bar Confederation, of all of these oligarchical groupings, they were the most obnoxious. I don't just mean that from a Catholic point of view. I mean that they were the most violent, that they were at least the most open, honest of all of these, because they stated their aims very clearly. And they were opposed by the crown, who, with a few exceptions, like the claimant during the time of troubles, for example, with few exceptions, the Polish monarch looked very positively on Orthodoxy. The only time, I mean, there are situations, and I've had podcasts on this in the past, where Polish army units, they're all connected to the different families, there was never a single standing army, would actually deliberately lose battles because they would fear that a war would make the crown more powerful. There's nothing that they wouldn't do. And this is really the central dividing line in world history, but certainly Slavic history, is that the monarchy and the oligarchy, whether nobles or not, are perpetually at war. Either you have the common good or you have self-seeking. And noble families, no matter what their background, there's nothing they won't do to maintain their power. Abbot Melchizedek was fluent in Latin and Greek. He also knew German, and he was educated, like so many others, at the Akiv Academy at the caves, what little was left of it. In 1764, just 4 years before the uprising, the Orthodox Church was banned. Now, it was always banned, but there was never any open decree that said, you know, you're finished if you're members of this church. It was. It was decreed clearly, and this was in Polish law, that being a member of the Orthodox Church from 1764 onward is a capital crime. It was a capital crime because it was treason. A very important distinction to make at the time was the ethnic concern. To be Orthodox was to be Ukrainian, Russian, Rusyn. To be Catholic was to be Polish or German. To be Orthodox at the time was to be a country bumpkin, an idiot, a fool. It's very hard to exaggerate how bad the Orthodox Church had become prior to the Union of Brest in 1595. Because of the constant oppression of the Orthodox population, the education went down to almost nothing. And making matters worse was that the Turkish control over the Patriarch of Constantinople meant that many of these men were not even Orthodox. So, canonically speaking, the Orthodox Church was almost non-existent at the time. It certainly was existent, extant, but both in Constantinople and in much of Russia, the canonical line had been severed. And there are many very good reasons that I've written on this, and I have many podcasts on this topic. It is a blind spot. Russian nationalists are going to have to deal with this. You're going to have to deal with the fact that there's a reason that the population had pulled away from the monarchy, that the monarchy fell into alien hands for quite a long time, only being resuscitated by Alexander I. Well, actually, I should say Paul I, who is a saint and has been canonized and murdered, by the way. The reason he's been canonized is that he's a martyr, another royal martyr who was murdered for wanting the restoration of old Russia. This is why Peter the Great's son, Peter the Great tortured his own son to death. Eudoxia was Peter's illegitimate wife, his first wife, who was imprisoned throughout his entire reign. But she was in a monastery, actually took to the monastic life very well. It actually became a little capital. And Peter was always very worried about it. He couldn't just kill her. You know, that would be too blatant for the population. So, you know, he made her become a nun. He had a bunch of women. He didn't care. And usually forcibly. And then he found this whore, professionally speaking, a whore in Germany. And quote-unquote married her. The Russian Orthodox Church was cut in half. The number of parishes and monasteries was less than half in the middle of the 18th century. But it was far worse in Ukraine, in Western Ukraine, under the Poles. The central document is the Treaty of Endusrova. This essentially divided Ukraine between the Russian Empire and the Polish Empire. Hetman Doroshenko, in desperation, went to the Turks, attempted to unify all of Ukraine under his scepter. The Turks and the Tartars were awful allies. They behaved badly. They promised him, they swore to him, that there was going to be no pillaging, no forcible conversions. They lied. And it was a complete and utter disaster. He defeated the Poles, he defeated the Russians, but in unifying Ukraine, he did it at the expense of the country. Remember, even Bogdan Khmelnytsky went to the Turks too at one point. Now, this has been done before, but trusting them was a huge mistake on his part. But it's really based on desperation. After the ruin, or during the ruin in Ukrainian history, Ukraine almost disappeared. So desperation was the order of the day. I don't blame Hetman Doroshenko, Peter Doroshenko, for this. He did what he thought was best, and he did win, except that he simply couldn't trust his Turkish ally. Once he had been defeated, Poland and Russia, because they had a common enemy, then signed a treaty that divided the country between them. And however, they did promise religious liberty. On both sides of the border, Orthodox and Catholic could be free without any government interference. Well, Melchizedek noticed that clearly wasn't the case in Western Ukraine. In the right bank, Melchizedek actually approached Catherine II very naively, asking for assistance. He even went to Krakow. He even went to the Polish crown, and was promised assistance. But he, you know, the crown had very little power. Catherine II liked the arrangement that she had with Poland. Catherine and the Masonic core of her rule hated the peasantry, hated the agrarian life. And the single most obnoxious thing that the Bar Confederation did was making serfs out of formerly free people, many of whom, by the way, were refugees from the Russian form of serfdom. Now, prior to the 18th century, prior to Peter and his successors, serfdom was not a problem. It simply guaranteed peasants' land. However, once Western tastes became dominant in the upper classes, serfdom became an issue. The high-level nobles saw themselves as pan-Europeans, speaking very bad French, sometimes German. They saw themselves as cosmopolitan, world travelers. Dostoevsky and Gogol mocked them relentlessly, and they deserve it. And they began trying to imitate Western magnates and work their serfs into the grave. Then it became a problem, but only among those who had, you know, many thousands of serfs, the upper levels of the nobility, who had been trained to see themselves as cosmopolitans. Worse still was that Catherine II had freed them from service. You want to come up with the most obnoxious thing to do at the time, you free the nobles from service. The nobility justified their position in society because they served the monarchy. They usually were soldiers, often with very difficult tasks, especially in the border areas. Oftentimes they worked in local government or in federal government. And they had a short lifespan. Especially in border areas, they struggled to maintain order. So in a sense, you know, their serfs were always able to say, well, the man who owns this estate suffers as much as we do. We know what he does. And it wasn't an oppressive system up until the 18th century. Catherine said the nobles no longer have to serve. That meant a lot of things. That meant, number one, oligarchy became absolute institutionalized in Russia. It ended later on, but at least for the time. Number two, nobles had nothing else to do. There was a professional bureaucracy now in Petersburg, and nobles really didn't have to do anything anymore. Number three, there was no justification for serfdom. Number four, because they were idle, they wanted more things, especially the females. They wanted more things from either the Orient, but mostly from Western Europe. That cost a lot of money, and that meant they needed to squeeze their serfs more and more and more. So we're not talking about all nobles, of course. The bulk of the nobility weren't bad guys. We're talking about the upper reaches, you know, the top 15% that owned an army of serfs. And the only thing that really rescued serfdom in that period was the fact they had the commune, which was never destroyed. So it meant that any overseer didn't deal with serfs as individuals. They dealt with the community. And then the head of the community would, who was always elected, would give out the duties as, you know, as he understood, and usually by a very fair procedure. The mayor kept them going. Well, that's extremely important to note. So it was always tolerable so long as that existed. So for those reasons and many more, the freeing of the nobility was an absolute disaster for Russia. The Russian nobles became very much like Polish ones. So here's the situation. Here's the context. 1760s, Doroshenko in Ukraine had fallen. Her independence was gone, divided between two empires. An illegitimate monarchy reigned in Russia. There were oligarchies on both sides. The grain trade had gone through the roof. And it meant that many landlords, even small ones, but mostly large ones, middle ones, really wanted to increase grain production. It meant they were working serfs a lot more than they had before. The concept of Western, you know, profiteering took hold of Russian nobles. The monarch, so-called, in St. Petersburg, didn't care whatsoever for peasant needs and cared only about her favorites and the nobility and the Masonic lodges. In the 1760s, roughly 42% of serfs had no draft animals of any kind, or really any animals that you can make money from. 28% had zero. A huge proportion, it differs depending on who you read, had no land whatsoever. They were proletarian. And Poles in the Bar Confederation were settling Poles from elsewhere into Ukrainian areas because they figured they could count on them more so than Slavic Orthodox peoples. So you have a massive increase of serfdom, a massive increase in the intensity of serfdom. You had an increase in the type of serfdom in the sense that these were formerly free people. You still had a functional and very powerful Cossack world. That was the only reason that Orthodoxy existed at all in the western part of Ukraine. It was the use of force. Without the Cossack threat, there would be no Ukrainian people, no Orthodox people in Western Ukraine whatsoever. You had landlords getting richer and richer and richer because of this explosion of the grain trade, clearly at the expense of serfs. The Orthodox Church was banned. Jews dominated the cities completely and held many of the deeds of their farms and churches, and you had to pay a fee to even use a church, the few that were left. The Orthodox peasantry in Western Ukraine were goyim in every sense of the word. And the Bar Confederation was willing to destroy even the slightest peep of protest. Needless to say, an extremely violent revolt broke out in 1768. The Haidamak Rebellion was nothing if not legitimate. To a great extent, it was an Old Believer Rebellion, but not entirely. And its two leaders were a very great man, Ivan Gonta and Maxim de Lizniak. This is the same word that means, I believe it means iron ore, iron products in Russian. These were the military leaders of the revolt. There were both Cossacks running smaller hetman units throughout the country. Melchizedek was blamed by most people as the instigator of the rebellion. And I don't know if this is true or not. Most people, no one really knows. But he certainly was involved in this revival, very sudden revival, in the Orthodox Church in Western Ukraine. Now, I started this talk by saying that the man should be canonized. I truly believe that. And I want this podcast to be the start of something that may lead to his canonization. The numbers of people who he was responsible for converting under these very harsh conditions are absolutely astounding. Before his death, Melchizedek had converted 530 Uniate parishes to the Orthodox Church. The Bar Confederation declared then that their property was forfeit, so there was no legal protection for their property. Anyone could have it if they wanted it. By 1794, about 332,000 Uniates had converted to Orthodoxy, and by 1800, about 2 million. The Uniates were wiped out in Western Ukraine by this man. Now, I'm not saying that he was converting them personally, but he was the spiritual foundation with the Cossack host, both in its you know, at the Sikh itself, as well as the locals who were living kind of a Cossack life, but not a part of the Sikh institution, were the muscle. The Polish Empire accused him of instigating pogroms against Jews and Poles in Western Ukraine. They said he was a terrorist, which shouldn't shock anybody. It's not exactly a new accusation. His monastery was razed to the ground in 1768. But he continued to be the spiritual leader of this revolution, and most certainly was. The agenda of this revolt and the writings of Zalizniak are the kind of Cossack sense of Christian equality that you would find in the prophets, especially in landholding. That there is one law for everyone, God's law. There isn't a law for Polish nobles and then a law for everybody else. There is only one canonical structure that should exist, legally speaking. He was convinced, and I believe it's certainly true, that he was a man fighting on God's side, that he was fighting on justice's side, and that it was very clear that the Bar Confederation was using torture as a means of preventing conversion. The concept of the Cossack way of life, which I've dealt on this program many years ago, was a pretty much a sort of a Russian communal structure of basically equal landholdings, but equal in a proportional sense, not in a mathematical sense, not in the sense of, you know, one-to-one. Between 1761 and 1771, 450 parishes were taken from the unions. These numbers are taken both from the Diocese of Pereslav, their own records, as well as the Poles themselves. And very early on, even before the rebellion broke out, there were about 150 priests that Melchizedek had brought to the Orthodox faith. And one of the strange aspects about this is that many of the clergy were not aware that they were unions. Now, this may sound very odd, but a lot of simple priests, because the liturgy was the same, the devotions were the same, the churches looked the same, adding the filioque was just something that they did to keep the soldiers out of their churches. Many of them were completely unaware that they were Catholics. Amongst the Russophiles, which I have a paper on my website about this, Ivan Yamovich, his post-Uniate movement, of which Alexei Toth in America is in the Carpatho-Russian Archdiocese right here in Johnstown, is based on this. They report that most of the people did not know that they were Catholics. It was much easier to control them if they just, you know, kept on doing whatever they were doing, but the money and the support of the higher clergy was clearly going to Rome. And even more so, Motulinski monastery was rebuilt and became a part of the Cossack Sikh institution. It became kind of the official monastery once it was put back together again of the Cossack host. And the differences between the Hetman state in Ukraine and the central institution of the Sikh, it's S-I-C-H, the central core in the rapids of the Dnieper River on an island, very hard to get to. The core there was an ascetic lifestyle. And these were warrior monks in every sense of the word, and a basic equality of land holding. And it differed only in proportion. Larger families get more than smaller families. Strong social welfare for those, for example, who are widows and orphans. It was a utopian approach to things. It was to try to put the life of the thoughts of the prophets of the Old Testament into action. And that's how they saw themselves. They saw themselves as warrior monks, even though, I mean, no women were allowed in the main fortress. They had to be completely focused. They were very much a sort of a legitimate aristocracy. The Cossacks, you know, we could talk about them forever. They're some of the greatest heroes in the history of the world. They saved hundreds of thousands of slaves from the Jewish slave march in the Black Sea. The island of Kaffa in particular. That's how they got their start. It was mostly Slavic, but not entirely. And the only thing was that you had to be Orthodox to be a member. And they were ascetics. They were very strict during Lent. And they had an independent church. It was very loosely associated with via the sea at the Kiev Caves. But Catherine the Great, needless to say, as you might not be surprised to hear, destroyed it as the troublemaking center of Ukraine. Catherine II ultimately condemned this rebellion and said in more than one document that the authority of the Polish nobles and the Bar Confederation is from God. Now, I'll have to do some digging to find out and show you exactly where that was uttered. I've translated it myself. I lost a bunch of files recently, unfortunately, but that is available upon request. And she said it more than once. So it shows that she was not Orthodox, that she simply didn't care, and that she was willing, under the authority of the Treaty of Andrusowo, that the Polish nobles had every right to Orthodox slaves, which is what they were at that point. It was much, much easier to treat them as slaves when they weren't Polish. However, they did settle Poles in the area as free laborers, as a way, hopefully, to keep the hegemon and ever developing ever again. In 1766, Abbot Melchizedek was tortured in a Polish prison for much of that year. He did escape, but not broken. And with all that pain, the semi-starvation, everything that he went through, he went right back and continued the revolt and continued this mass conversion effort. This man, not one monastery, but the Cossacks and local peasants behind him, instituted a massive revival of the Orthodox Church in Western Ukraine. And it was condemned and eventually destroyed by the Russian state in St. Petersburg, openly siding with the Polish nobility. So this revolt, as it developed into the Kulawesina revolt later on, very similar, they often get confused. It's a slightly later revolt, but it was the same mentality, the same enemies. It was as much an anti-Russian revolt as it was an anti-Polish revolt. There were both anti-Jewish revolts. That was very clear. Jews are mentioned in Pugachev, wherever you go, whenever there's the Polish connection, Jews are right there center. About 80% of the world's Jews lived in the Polish Empire during this period of time. And they, as I've spoken many times before, were organized into the Kahal system, and it's too far off the topic, but they were the bankers for the nobility. They were the go-between for the nobility. They were able to plug the leaders of the Bar Confederation into this huge international network that they had. They were the dominant force. It's true that the nobles had the power and had the private armies. In Poland, all armies were private. But none of this could happen without the financial connections of the Jews. This is one area where mainstream historians do criticize the Jews, which it's got to tell you something. Even, you know, especially if it's written by a Ukrainian, mainstream textbooks in this era have to paint the Jews in bad terms. There is no getting around it. Their behavior is absolutely abominable. They completely controlled the alcohol trade, of course, coming from the same grain trade. And they were the bankers. They were they forwarded the credit. They were the cities in Ukraine and elsewhere. And the Polish nobles developed, like so many noble classes, developed the notion that they were above commerce. That commerce and profit is beneath a noble class. Now that is true. I think it's true in general. But in this particular case, these guys were doing it because they were so woefully ignorant about business. They never had to learn. They gave everything over to the Jews in the Kahal system within the cities. And so the overwhelming majority of the land was controlled by them, either directly or indirectly. And unfortunately, even mainstream historians have been forced to concede that, and that their behavior was. And at the same time, even Gonta, one of the smaller Cossack leaders, very much from the Sikh, very much the mentality is the same, protected Jews in Uman and many other places. He's accused of pogroms. But the truth of the matter is, unfortunately, I have to read Ukrainian for this, but he did protect innocent Jews and women and children during the war. Because quite frankly, the Ukrainian population wanted to rip them apart, literally. Their rule was very obnoxious and very open. And they always had the Bar Confederation behind them. The Bar Confederation was also very Roman Catholic. They believed themselves, it may just be a slight exaggeration to say that they believed themselves to be crusaders. But the crusade was very specific. So we're talking about Abbot Melchizedek. We're talking about not just a conversion of hundreds of thousands of people and hundreds of parishes. That's enough. But even more than that, we're talking about conversion under this system where it was illegal to become Orthodox. Once these people realized that they were actually giving money not to the Orthodox Church, but to the Catholic Church, and hence the Polish state, they converted immediately. The lower clergy were only dimly aware that there was some change in their ecclesiastical connections. Now, in the cities, that wasn't the case. The bishops were well aware that there were unions, and they profited handsomely from it. Union bishops were extremely cynical, with a few exceptions, of course, and were very wealthy. But the simple priests were controlled based on ignorance. They didn't know who they were. Abbot Melchizedek, it was just a matter of letting them know what they were, the reasons for it, who they were serving, and of course, at the country, at the local level, they knew exactly the conditions of the peasantry. And once this was understood, made clear, and proven to them, Melchizedek went to Catherine II. She promised assistance, of course, but ultimately sided with the Poles. Bizarrely enough, the only person, the single person that showed any interest at all, was the King of Poland. And yet even today, the treatment of this topic is, let me read to you from, this is under the Kolia Vyshyna entry in Wikipedia. This is what this idiot writer says. The uprising resulted in mass murder of noblemen and other Polish people in the Polish Empire, Jews, Unionists, and Catholics, and their priests across the part of the country with the Dnieper River. At Uman, it led to a massacre of legendary proportions. Poles, Jews, and Unionists were herded into their churches and synagogues and killed in cold blood. In 3 weeks of unbridled violence, the rebels slaughtered 20,000 people, according to numerous Polish sources. That makes great copy. Unfortunately, not a shred of it is true. The fact that it's Polish sources, I'm sure you could find God knows all kinds of things in Polish. That's not exactly an unbiased account. None of that is true whatsoever. It is true that that sort of thing happened to Ukrainians all the time under Polish rule. But because so much to the left hates the peasantry, so much to the left hates the poor. You still hear it with trailer trash kind of talk amongst leftists today. This revolt is absolutely anathema to them. And the worst part of all of this is that in the late 1760s, people like Zelizniak and Gonta, believing that at least some Russians were willing to assist them in their meetings with Catherine's commanders, were arrested and their detachments completely disarmed. So here you have an example of an uprising under these conditions where the Russian state vehemently took action against the peasantry, against the peasant leaders. And finally, of course, Catherine did the obvious thing from her point of view. The final play here was that the Bar Confederation and the Polish government, so to speak, had approached Catherine II for assistance, citing that she was obliged to assist them because of the treaty, and that this was these were peasant nobodies and they needed to be crushed. And of course, from Catherine's point of view, the obvious thing was to destroy the Cossack movement, and she destroyed the Sixth in 1775. And so the Cossack movement, at least at the time, was completely destroyed. Russian nationalists have to be careful here. The Russian state, although totally alien from the Russian population, was at war with the Cossacks, and at this period of time supported feudalism in its worst sense, and supported the destruction of Orthodoxy and its own people in Ukraine. But in the 18th century, this was par for the course, unfortunately, for the Russian state. The Hadamaki, the Kolia Vyshyna movement, was God's movement, was a prophetic movement, was righteous, and these men were martyrs. Even Gonta was tortured to death, an unbearable pain. But as I read to you, the venom against these guys knows no bound. And here it was Russia that destroyed it. Russia was at war with Orthodoxy. And it was consistently, with the exception of Elizabeth, But other than her reign, it was consistently against the church, and cut her numbers in half by the time of Emperor Paul. I believe that because of these conversions and his torture and everything else, that Abbot Melchizedek Jaworski should be canonized. But because of the hatred of the Jews, most people are afraid of this. And that's the reason why he has been canonized as to now. I want his name to become more popular. I believe he deserves it. Converting that many people under those conditions is proof of, it's a miracle. It can't be explained any other way. Many of them were killed right afterwards. They were aware of what would happen to them. This is, to say the least, extraordinary. So I thank you for listening. I thank my friends for their assistance of me, towards me. It really has it's changed my life for the better. You're the reason I keep on going. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for all of this. I want to thank my enemies because you keep me on my toes. You keep me sharp. You guys are dullards, but you keep me sharp. I know I have to watch myself and make sure I have everything cited and everything correct. So, you know, you do serve a purpose, just like Satan serves a purpose in our life on Earth here. And I thank my friends. I thank everyone who has helped me and supported me in any way, shape, matter, or form. I truly pray for the canonization of Abbot Melchizedek. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.